Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from June 29, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the three marks of existence. The current political climate was discussed in relation to impermanence, not self, and stress. There is a related article on the website, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. Tonight's talk is on the three marks of existence: anicca, impermanence, anatta, the not self characteristic, and dukkha.
Let me just get my triple pillows.
I was mentioning to Kevin earlier, this is such an important understanding if we're going to develop an understanding of Buddha's Dhamma. This describes the environment that we live in. It describes how we develop wrong views of self and how the interplay of those two things results in...
What was the topic? I'm sorry.
The three marks of existence.
Oh.
Anicca, impermanence. Anatta, the not self characteristic, and dukkha, ongoing disappointment and suffering. And it could truly be said that ignorance of these three marks of existence, another way of saying that is they're common human experiences.
Mm-hmm.
We live in an impermanent environment. We suffer because we don't understand self. Anatta means not self. What that refers to is that the views you hold of yourself aren't an accurate, realistic view of self. And so the implication is let go of the views. How do we do that? Through an Eightfold Path. Dependent origination states. From ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. What is it that is ignorant? It's this not self characteristic. It's this self that is rooted in wrong views. And notice the Buddha is not saying there's no such thing as a self, which is a complete misunderstanding of the Buddha's teachings. All that he's saying is that the views that you hold to describe yourself are wrong views. Hence the first factor of the Eightfold Path, right view. That's what we're developing. The Buddha's words on impermanence. Be mindful of impermanence to end conceit. Conceit is another word for eye-making. If we truly understand the impermanence of all things, especially self-referential views, will cease creating a self out of those views. And what is our self-referential views? It's eye-making, it's conceit. Seeing things always in a personal way. That's clear, isn't it? When impermanence is understood, it is also understood that none of this is self. Meaning all of the things, when the Buddha describes the problem of dukkha, he describes it that we join ourselves with suffering, with disappointment. And when we can recognize that none of this is self, another way of saying that is not taking anything at all personally, suffering is. If suffering is rooted in that self-identification, that joining with physical form, with the world, and we let go of that, there's no ground for suffering. There's no ground for distraction. There's no ground for confusion.
But if someone is trying to hurt you, literally or figuratively,
yep.
How can you... Or if their actions hurt you, even if you don't care what they think, or you can remove yourself from what they think as... But if what they do hurts people or you... How does one not take it personally? Because they're personally trying to hurt you.
Because if that's truly the case, and it is, it's not to say that it doesn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that try to hurt other people
right.
in the world. Sometimes individually, sometimes on a global level.
Right.
It occurs. It occurs out of ignorance. And when we truly understand where it comes from, we can cease the judgment or the hatred that follows from that. But that doesn't mean that we condone any of the behavior, and it certainly doesn't mean that we should put ourselves in a position where we have to absorb the suffering that
mm-hmm.
others are trying to inflict on us. You get out of the way. I think it was the first retreat we did. We were talking on a somewhat similar subject about not self. And
mm-hmm.
And this one person asked this question, and he was kind of agitated. Well, what do you do if a train's coming at you? Take two steps to the right. You get out of the situation. It doesn't mean that developing awakening doesn't mean that you put yourself in a position to be harmed.
I understand that, but I'm thinking in a more not like an immediate physical harm kind of thing. But you know, we talked, I guess, a couple weeks ago that you know I'm starting to feel a lot of distress at how people in the country are being treated by their own government. Basically, primarily in terms of healthcare, but other things as well. And they're hurting so many people. And yes, we can act to try and change that. But how does one not take it personally when they are basically, you know,
part of
telling people that you don't matter? I mean, well, your life literally does not matter to these people. And it doesn't matter.
There's a few things going on in what you're saying. One, and I don't want to get into a political discussion because that's fraught with danger.
But it's
but there's a perception there that you're developing that may not be completely truthful. And I'm only saying that because that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
When the Buddha describes dependent origination, how from ignorance through 12 observable causative links all manner of suffering arises, the second link in that chain is fabrications. Another word for fabrications is assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of assumptions, and not just what you're saying. There's a lot of assumptions in what everybody's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I would say on both sides of the political spectrum. And all of those assumptions are rooted in ignorance. Now, this gets right to the heart of the matter of what you're talking about. If you can remove the idea that there's right and wrong in the situation you're describing, in other words, and just from your words, you're implying that the government, and I guess we can probably say the president,
the Congress,
or the Republicans, are wrong, and the other side is right. And
not even that far.
Let me finish. Both of those are, to the person holding the particular view, their view is right. Right?
It's relative.
So both of those views are, in essence, wrong, because
they can't both
be right.
Yeah.
They're views that are themselves arising, at least in part, from ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Where am I leading with this? When the Buddha describes suffering, he first describes it in a personal way, but then he takes it in a general way. The world, there's such a thing as worldly causes and conditions, and those conditions are part of dukkha. It's simply part of living in the world. It seems immediate right now, right? And living in the world that we are right now, it seems like to some people we are in the worst shape we are as a country right now. Many people believe that. I've lived long enough to experience that almost through every presidency. It's always the worst. It's always the worst, or it's always the best.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the truth of it is? The Buddha hit it. It's somewhere in the middle of that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can find a way, and this gets right to the heart of your matter, what do you do when it seems like there's a system in place that's hurting people, there's a system in place that's hurting me? What can I do? I can develop the Dhamma and develop a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring, because then I'll stop taking all of that personally.
And then I can act on it.
Let me take it one more step. How do you take it? If you really believe that a government or a president is directly taking action for the purpose of hurting people, notice I'm not arguing whether he is or not, but if you really believe that, the solution still is to develop the Dhamma and awaken and stop taking that personally. It may be true.
It removed power for them as well. If everyone did that, they would lose.
Well, that's true. If everyone did it, but that's not the reason to do it. The only reason the only impact we can truly have on any system is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. History has proven that. The Buddha, this is 2,600 years ago, developed his Dhamma in a time of great political upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
There was constant war going on, almost exactly like what's going on today. The only real difference is we didn't have instantaneous global communication. In other words, we didn't know
mm-hmm.
how bad it was,
mm-hmm.
but it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in some ways it was even worse. The people that were ruthless were as ruthless as anybody we have today.
Yeah, well, I understand that, yes.
The Buddha was called to advise rulers. In fact, there's quite a few suttas where a ruler is ready to go to war to protect or to gain whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And they would consult the Buddha. It was common that they would find whoever they thought was the most advanced spiritual teacher. They want him on their side. And the Buddha had a reputation. So they would call the Buddha in. And the Buddha didn't say, absolutely not, I'm not going to deal with you because you're going to hurt people. Mm-hmm. What he did was count. He knew that that was unrealistic. And he knew that no matter what he said, they were going to go to war. What he did was to counsel them on what to do when they won. Treat people fairly. Treat people with dignity. Even those that you, in fact, he would say, those that you conquer, treat them like they're your own. Mm-hmm. Because that was realistic. We should do the same thing in this political climate. And in fact, it really is the only thing we can do. Whether it's because we feel that a system is hurting other people or we think that we are going to be hurt directly. What can we do about it? Metaphorically, we take two steps to the right. Realistically, we get on our cushions, we develop concentration, and we develop right mindfulness, a way of seeing the world clearly. The first noble truth, in its most simplistic way of stating it, is dukkha occurs. As a consequence of living in the world, there's going to be dukkha. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that if we're going to do anything about it, the most important thing is that our actions, our thoughts, our words, and our deeds are rooted in the framework of the Eightfold Path. So when we find ourselves wanting to engage in the common rhetoric of hate, whether it's going this way or that way, we remember right speech. Is what I'm saying truthful? Even if that other person... So I'm going to get a little bit political. I think what he said, tweeted last night about that person on NBC, is probably one of the worst things I've ever heard a president say. It's hard for me to... on a personal level, to understand and accept
it.
But
they would say publicly. Yeah, I'm sure they said worse behind the scenes, yeah.
But it's also what occurred. Ideally, I mean, I have an ideal of what I'd like my president to be, too, and it's not that. Yeah. But this gentleman, and I'm sincere when I'm calling him a gentleman, is the president of the United States. I don't think he's all bad. I don't think he's all good. Mm-hmm. I've been conscious of, I can't remember how many presidents. I don't remember Eisenhower, but I do remember Kennedy, mm-hmm. and I remember I've been somewhat mindful of what's occurred in the world. Mm-hmm. I didn't pay much attention during the Obama years. Maybe I should have, but I really kind of withdrew from the world. The point that I'm making is every one of them in their own way were wonderful people, and every one of them in their own way were scoundrels. That's the nature of the world. I think that the office itself can only support very compassionate scoundrels. I think that's what it is.
Well, yeah, you have to have a pretty big ego to get
there. Yeah, and the system that we have in play. I was thinking about this today. I think the political system that we have in this country, as awful as it is one of the most amazing systems for a country this big.
Well, the quote is, was it Franklin or someone said, it's a horrible, it's the worst system except for all the other ones.
That's right. and so if you look at that in perspective, mm-hmm. dukkha occurs as a consequence of living in the world, as a consequence of having the need for political system. We're not in a position on this planet where we can say, well, we're all awakened and we can simply govern ourselves. We can't. You know, we can't even govern our cities very well, can we? So we certainly can't just say we don't need governance. We do. And the people that are going to end up in a position of governing more than likely are going to be rooted in ignorance. We can't really expect much more than that. So what we can do is understand the process that the world that we're living in, and take care of our own mindfulness. And then treat people from the framework of the Eightfold Path, especially the moral and ethical aspects, including people we disagree with, including people that may or may not be intentionally hurting people. So excuse the long answer to that question, but it's an important question.
Yeah,
it comes up a lot.
Because this is the key to everything.
Well, this kind of gets to the talk, and I probably, since I talk so much right now, I probably won't get to the whole talk, but it really gets to the heart of the matter of taking things personally. The one thing we should learn to not take personally is politics. It's the worst thing we can, because it's not personal. It's not personal at all, even though it's occurring, it seems like it's occurring to us. What's occurring to me? Realistically, what's occurring to me?
Well, the machinations, yes, are, but the policy that can result can be very personal, have personal effects.
That's part of living in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that we should be completely detached.
Mm-hmm.
Another reason why we shouldn't get so upset over anybody in office, we have one of the most powerful tools in any kind. This isn't a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a monarchy.
So that's what you act. Mm-hmm.
In 4 more years, we get to vote again. Next year, we get to vote on Congress, on those representatives. That's a remarkable system. And if we're mindful of that system, we don't have to lose our minds over what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't like it, we can change it pretty quickly. When we stop taking things so extremely personal, we'll remember that. I mean, there's been a lot of violent protests from both sides too.
Yeah, no,
and that's because of mindlessness. We forget that I don't have to hurt other people because I'm frustrated. I can take a breath, and next year I can take a vote.
And not to belabor the point, it's just that I know people who are immediately affected by things, and I know a lot of, and it's not even me that. I could be affected too, but I'm more concerned about the other people who are going to be way more affected. And, it's not that I think there's easy answers or anything, that one side's all right and one side's all wrong. I just get a sense that there, harm is being propagated without any caring. And I'm not pointing at one particular person or anything like that. It's kind of a thought. And that, I see people suffering because of this, and, it's hard not to blame
It's hard not to blame, but if we want to blame something, blame ignorance,
mm-hmm.
because that's where it belongs. And that leads directly to the solution. That doesn't mean that the solution will arise. It just means we'll recognize where it's coming from. And it doesn't imply that there's only ignorance in one direction.
I don't think that. I'm just thinking about the direct effects that I'm seeing in one particular area that, to me, is so easy to not do that.
So let me give.
I don't want to take any more time, but
I think this is important.
Yeah, it's very hard for me to reconcile that these are other human beings I should have empathy for.
But Judy, I think you also have to realize that this is using the specific issue of healthcare. Kevin, you can speak about this probably better than I can, but this is not. It's not just now and in the future that people suffered because of the healthcare system in this country. It's been going on as long as I can remember, as long as I've been in the world. I mean, I can think of times, even when I was a kid, that people that I knew that got involved in the healthcare system that died because of what they're not because of the medical care they were giving, because of the system that they had to deal with. This is nothing new.
No, you're right. Heck, I almost do too. So.
Well, I can tell you that I don't want to get too personal, but people in my own family, because of the system that was in place 18 years ago, ended up being a vegetable. And mm-hmm. it wasn't because of the direct medical care. It was because of the choices they had to make within the system that was there. What I'm real referring to is because of insurance companies. So I'm not trying to blame them. It's always been like this. This is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
The I don't want to get too political.
You're right.
The point I'm making is all of this is a consequence of living in the world.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I don't talk a lot about in my classes or even in my books, although I imply it, the point of awakening is to not be here anymore. It's to stop creating the conditions to be part of the worldly causes and conditions. It's to get this over with. And again, this is getting into the talks on karma and rebirth. Having a human life in this world is always going to be prone to suffering. It relates to the talk tonight that I don't think we're going to get to, but the Buddha's description of suffering. Birth is suffering. Why is birth suffering? That's the first definition that he uses to describe suffering. Why is it? Because we're being born into a world that is always going to be subject to this type of life. Then he says, sickness is suffering. Of course it is, isn't it? And it's even more so today. Aging is suffering, death is suffering. And those are aspects of trying to hold on to something that we can't hold on to anymore. Youth, vibrancy, a good life, or even a bad life. And then because we're so enamored with this thing called self, we don't even want to think about death, but it's going to happen. And then he goes on to say not getting what is wanted is suffering. And that's certainly what's happening right now, isn't it? In an individual way, but at least in a national and a global way. At least half the people in this world aren't getting what they want, and they're focusing that on one office.
It's true.
And another component of the population, they're not getting what they want because those people won't listen to me. Not getting what you want is suffering. Then the Buddha says, getting what you don't want is suffering. Maybe a healthcare system that you really would rather be different, that's suffering. Why is this important? Because it's all part of living in the world. It's all part of worldly causes and conditions rooted in ignorance. And then he might say a few other things, and he would always close that with saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. What are the five clinging aggregates? The five clinging aggregates is the personal experience of suffering, caught up in that whole process of wanting things to be different. And now we're getting to maybe the heart of the matter and the heart of anatta. Because of self-referential views, we see ourselves in everything that occurs, and so we take everything personal. If we stop those self-referential views, then we just see the arising and the passing away of all phenomena, including temporary political systems, temporary worldly conditions, temporary gas prices. It's all temporary. Once we can understand that, we stop taking any of it personally. It's really kind of the key. This is what we just talked about to start this. So this all kind of fits into, at least, impermanence and the not-self characteristic. We take these things personally, and once we do that, then we have approval and acceptance locked up. An awakened mind, or I should say even an awakening mind, disconnects those two. And when we stop taking things personally, then we realize that I don't have to approve of anything, but I can accept everything. Simply because it's what's occurring. And that allows us a level of mindfulness that is not possible unless we can accept things dispassionately and impersonally. It's simply what's occurring. Then I can speak without, if I'm in a position, Fox News calls and wants to hear what I have to say, or CNN, or all of them, then I can speak from a level of reasonable and rational mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And I might say something, you know, the problem is ignorance. And it's ignorance on both sides. Why don't we try to address that? In essence, what we've been trying to do in this country since the beginning of time, and I'm not saying it's unreasonable, it's the only thing we can do, is to legislate against any possibility of suffering. It's what we hope to do with a health care law.
I don't think that's what people are really thinking.
No, it's not what they're really thinking, but it's what they're hoping.
They're clinging.
That's impossible because
it is
sick in healthcare, so they're going to be suffering.
People don't consider it possible; they consider it ideal.
Do you think people really think they can create a healthcare system without suffering?
I think they're hoping to. They're hoping to legislate against any possibility of anybody ever being hurt by any political system. It's impossible to do. We can't do it. Well, there's always going to be, now we're really getting into something. We're trying to fit a social ideal in a free market, and that's the real problem.
But that's
because we have ideologues on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to solve the problem, we've got to decide we're either going to be socialist or we're going to have a free market economy. And that really is going to come down to it. But who knows where that's going to that's something. Kevin, you're in, and you don't have to say anything. You know, I'm calling you out of your coming here for meditation and Dharma practice. But do you have anything from your unique point of view that you'd like to say?
Well, I think it's interesting. It has to do with impermanence too. I mean, this administration is making all these declarations, and they believe that they're right. And I think they think that part of the problem is we're spending too much money, and if we spend less money, then things will be better. And it's just their point of view. But their point of view is also impermanent.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of impermanence.
Yep.
And we can't. Well, and I do take it to heart, but we need to try not to take it to heart because it is impermanent. It's something that is going to pass.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it could pass for something that's worse. You know, might be the good days.
Yeah.
So, and it is the good days. I mean, it's talking. There's a lot of anger, but you know, if you don't take it personally, it can be the best days.
Yeah, and that's the point of the Dhamma. Don't take it personally. Every day can be a day of equanimity, no matter what is going on in the world. And again, that let's bring it back to the Dhamma. When the Buddha describes himself prior to his awakening, he described himself as an unawakened bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is a human being of deep compassion, but lacking understanding of the Four Noble Truths. That's why he described himself as an unawakened. He was a human being with great compassion, but he lacked the wisdom that came from understanding the Four Noble Truths. So there's many, many people that are deeply compassionate and they're deeply offended by what they think is occurring. The reason why they get, just to use the phrase, lose their mind over it, is because they're lacking an understanding of the nature of suffering in the world. And there's nothing personal about it. It's a consequence of living in the world. Now, we have a system that we're all a part of. We should participate in the system, but losing our mind because the system isn't working the way we hope, we're not getting what we want in this moment, should also be recognized as part of dukkha. If we lose our mind, if we react, we're in trouble.
Yeah, and I see that on both sides. And that's not.
Yeah.
I agree that it is not helpful. And I'm not dogmatic, and I don't say there's only one way or the highway kind of thing. I'm not like that at all. To me, there's a level of callousness going on that's, you know, not necessary. And so then what's the reason for it? But I try.
Ignorance.
And there we go. And so I really have to have a perspective where I say, okay, everyone's struggling to figure out what to do, and no one really knows what to do.
Yeah, that's I always say that's true.
Mm-hmm.
If you can really understand that, I just called. There's a lot of scoundrels. That's one of my favorite words, because I think it's gentle enough to describe people that are kind of out for themselves, but they're not really full of hate. They're just scoundrels.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have some really brilliant people in government,
mm-hmm.
And it's like when I was in business, there was a few times I got in trouble. Not for any, you're in the world, you get people want to sue you. And when I hired a lawyer, I was relieved because I left it up to them.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to, I mean, you know, I gave the input that I needed and I monitored what was going on. But I was able to, I gave a lot of money. But again, but part of that is I was paying for peace of mind.
Yes.
And so they have the job to do. And there's nothing much for me to do until they either succeed or fail. Mm-hmm. And then I take it. I don't need to lose my mind on a daily basis over what's occurring,
mm-hmm.
because I participated in a system that I think is one of the most reasonable systems. I voted, and you know now we live with that.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm not even getting on that. I'm trying not to be an angry person. It's more of a concern. But you're right, I do tend to get angry towards certain individuals that I know are kind of leaders in the area. And I'm trying to pay attention to the meta.
Good.
But it's hard sometimes. It is very hard sometimes.
It's extremely hard. It seems like it's getting more and more difficult, but believe me, Judy, the rhetoric is probably at a level that I haven't seen in quite a long time. There was a little bit of this going on when Mr. Reagan took office too, by the way. But it died down, I think, a little quicker. What I'm saying is, even though the rhetoric is really extreme right now, it's like foam on the ocean. There's nothing behind it except ignorance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There really isn't. It's part of worldly causes and conditions. One of the great things about developing the Dhamma is you can be a part of the world without the need to react to it. You can simply be present. And if you do, what's the Chinese saying? It's wonderful to live in interesting times. These are probably the most interesting times we've had, you know?
The Chinese curse to be living interesting times?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's and what is a consequence? Even if it's true that Mr. Trump really is the way that that the extremes want to see him, and he's really out to hurt millions of people. He can't wait for old people and sick people to suffer more. Even if that's true,
he'll go away eventually.
It'll all go away.
Yeah.
Maybe let me get to Anatta. It's the people that may be affected. And by the way, I needed to say, because this is going on, I don't believe that that's his intention.
No, I'm not saying.
So, but even if it was, what he's affecting is like foam on the ocean.
It's hard. I see your point. It's just very hard to get there. Yeah.
It is.
It's a lot more foam than usual.
that's right.
So beat the egg
and it's thicker than it's ever been.
Yeah.
The answer really is compassion married with wisdom, because it takes wisdom. How can you be compassionate about someone that you think the way many people think of our president? How can you? The only way is if you have the wisdom to see the situation clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the the situation with that kid Otto Warmbier, that mm-hmm. awful thing that happened to him. It would seem reasonable for anybody to hate. I can't think of his Un, Kim Jong Un, the president of North Korea. That would seem like a really reasonable thing to hate him.
Yeah.
When I heard about that, I got to say, I had an initial reaction of anger. But I very quickly went to understanding what an awful mind to have to live with that would do something like that.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. So I could be compassionate towards Kim Jong-un, I think. But that doesn't mean I approve of what he's doing.
Yeah.
But that takes a certain, not that I'm the wisest person in the world, but that takes a certain amount of wisdom. Because most of us would think that the only way that I could be compassionate about Otto Warmbier is to lose my mind about the person that did it to him.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than seeing the whole situation clearly. Of course, what an awful thing that happened.
And that's not always the case. I mean, there are many people who have have had a family member killed by someone who's on death row, and they don't want them to be killed. And
yep.
they have developed a relationship with these people to try and understand them. And, yeah, so people do that. Mm-hmm. And I have to put myself in that perspective that you can't change any. If everyone's just yelling at each other, anyway, you won't be able to change anything anyway.
Can't. It just gets worse and worse.
Right.
You get... Okay. Let's see what... Let me just read this over again. Then I'm going to get to anatta and what the Buddha's words on anatta, and then we'll wrap it up. Be mindful of impermanence to end conceit. When impermanence is understood, it is also understood that none of this is self. None of it. Understanding not self uproots conceit, uproots eye-making. When fully established, release is complete. That's the Buddha's teachings on that, on Nietzsche. When you understand, remember when the Buddha gave his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and Kandana understood it. He said, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. He's talking about impermanence there at a very profound level. Now, you weren't here, I think you were here for some of the talks on restraint and mindfulness. We're recognizing the arising and the passing away of all things. In the moment, it's our breath that arises and passes away. On a political scene, it's a president that arises and passes away. Or issues that arise. But they all arise and pass away. They all have nothing as their real footing, as their real establishment. They're all part of this ongoing system of dukkha that's rooted in ignorance. So the ultimate answer, the solution to all the problems is an individual one. Recognize your own ignorance of Four Noble Truths and awaken. So let me just to kind of finish the class tonight. Now, I won't get into dukkha tonight, but that's really what we're talking about. A little bit more on impermanence, the Buddha's words. Friends, form, meaning physical objects in the physical body, is like foam. Seeing clearly, form is empty and without substance. Whether past, present, or future, internal, external, subtle, or obvious, seeing form as it is, like foam on the water, brings wisdom to the well-instructed. Clearly seeing, they become disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling. Now he's relating this to the five clinging aggregates. Disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrications, meaning our assumptions about how things should be, and disenchanted with consciousness. In this context, consciousness is just simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. Disenchanted, one grows dispassionate. With dispassion comes release from craving and clinging, wanting things to be different than they are. Friends, when a learned follower has heard the truth and understands the truth, they will no longer cling to form or to feeling or to perceptions or to fabrications or to the flow of thoughts. They will clearly see this as this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, and they are fully released. He's talking about not taking anything so personally. When you react to the idea that people might get hurt for whatever reason, the reaction is caused by taking it personal. We think that that's
compassion.
We think it's magnanimous compassion, that we think we should feel that way, that we should have a reaction. But we can be compassionate and marry that with wisdom, with true wisdom, and we won't react. It doesn't mean we won't act, we won't react. We won't react, meaning react is something that comes from ignorance. Acting is something that we can engage in mindfully from a place of wisdom. And what might that be? Well, it would certainly be engaging in dialogue if it was necessary, framed by the Eightfold Path, rather than going to extremes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for one thing. And if we're in a position to influence anything, we can do that from a place of great wisdom too, like the Buddha did. I mean, I don't know that any of us are going to be called, you know, what should we do here, on a global thing. But locally, we can certainly do that, can't we?
Mm-hmm.
To our friends that are getting caught up in the rhetoric and losing their minds over, we can say, wait a minute, this is how I see it. all of this is rooted in ignorance. People are reacting because they don't really understand what's occurring here. It's all impermanent. It's like foam on the ocean.
The react and acting got to me. I think that was a good one. From my perception.
And finally said something right.
No, it's true. When you react, you're not acting out of any particular thought or understanding. You're just having an emotional reaction.
You're protecting your ego.
Mm-hmm. How dare someone?
Yeah. And what is the ego? Ego's like foam on the ocean. Why? Take this just a little bit further. It takes so much effort to keep this self-referential ego self, this thing that can become so self-righteous,
mm-hmm.
and think that it has all the answers. I mean, I look back on myself and some of the things that I've done, you know, not all that long ago, sorry to say,
mm-hmm.
that I felt so right, but really self-righteous about what I was doing and the causes I was taking up. And they're all rooted in ignorance. They're all because I thought that I was right, and I'm going to prove it to everyone.
Yeah, and I am really not like that. I don't pretend to necessarily know what the answer is of any particular issue. Sometimes I may have a strong opinion, and sometimes I may not, but I don't think it's the only approach. I'm fairly pragmatic. If someone can come up with something that works, fine. That does what it's supposed to do without causing too much damage. I'm okay. I'm not. So, but you know, my husband said, "You forget how angry you were when XYZ was president." I'm like, "Oh, you're right. Well," I go, "But this is worse." He goes, "Yeah, but you said that was the worst." And so, like I said, he's a natural Buddhist. Because he's saying exactly what you're saying.
They, in my life, they've all been scoundrels, and they've all had their good parts.
Well,
I probably shouldn't say this. I think Richard Nixon was one of the great foreign policy presidents we've ever had.
Yeah.
He was also, you know, a little nuts and a bit of a thief, but
yeah.
You know, he was a typical president.
So. So when you hear what he was personally, he was a miserable person.
He was
miserable to others, and he was miserable to himself. But he was still able to do certain things that had good consequences, useful consequences.
Yeah. The whole point is that we can't. We would like anything we're doing that we're spending a lot of time in, especially Dhamma practice, to also be applicable to solving all the world's ills.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what a so-called spiritual practice should be? Well, that's not what the Buddha taught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he never intended it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the intention is really just the opposite,
yeah.
To recognize that the ills of the world are the ills of the world. What we can do is to develop calm and peaceful minds that continually rest in equanimity. Our minds are always at peace, despite what's going on around us. We can maintain peaceful qualities of mind. And that really is the point. That's the only thing that we have any control over. But from that, the Buddha brought great peace to northern India at the time when there wasn't any peace.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't bring total peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he didn't try to. He,
right.
He knew that was impossible. But he affected the people around him,
right.
In a way that led to great peace. We can do the same.
Yeah, I think that's the whole point. If people are of a calm mind instead of having extremes, always doing this with each other, then you can accomplish something.
Yeah, it seems very difficult at times when the world is really going crazy, which it is. I mean, it is.
It is pretty bad, right?
It seems like, well, you know, I can't meditate in this. I can't develop the Dhamma. I don't have a right to be peaceful when everybody else isn't. Well,
that is, yeah.
You know, that's part of the ego. I was saying that to recognize the I in me. I can't do this. I shouldn't do that. That's self-referential. That's being joined with the world. When we take true refuge, you know, the Ratana Sutta, take true refuge in the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha, What that means is we're seeing the world clearly and we're recognizing what we can and can't do. And really, the only thing we can do, the only thing, I would say, the only thing we really should feel strongly about is to awaken. It's the most important thing. Personally, I think that the only real salvation for the world, not that the Dhamma is salvific, is if more people would take to the Dhamma and see things realistically. To that end, I sent the White House one of my books. I don't expect that the Secret Service is going to be clearing this room for the Donald to have a meditation with us, but you never know.
Yeah, he vacations nearby.
He does.
I pass the Trump golf course on my way to work every day.
Do you?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I do.
So it was a really good discussion you brought tonight.
Hey, I'm sorry if it was too one-sided, but it's a practical. How do you take, you know, these things sound very nice, and then in real life, how do you eventually get to the point where you can actually do them in real life?
Well, when you find yourself getting
yeah.
agitated in mm-hmm. any way,
right?
Remind yourself, this is not yeah. me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. You're reminding yourself that you don't have to join with dukkha. You don't have to join with the suffering. It seems like that's a requisite of living in the world. We should join with it. It's really just the opposite.
Yeah, that compassion almost means joining with the suffering. But the people who are the most effective in combating suffering, in helping to relieve suffering, are the people that can go into a terrible situation and keep their wits about them and help people.
Yep, just like the boot. The
Medicine sans frontières.
The Ratana Sutta was taught to a town that was devastated by floods and then disease.
Mm.
And the first thing the Buddha did when he heard of this, he went into the town. He had, I think, about 500 monks and nuns with him. The first thing they did is they attended to the physical needs of the people. They cleaned them up. They, you know, they provided whatever medicine and care they could give. They gave them some food. And then the Buddha sat the town down and taught them the Dhamma. And basically what he's saying is these things that are going to occur, but if you develop this, you can take care of your own peace and well-being through the Dhamma. That was his response to a great disaster. And he did that repeatedly. We first take care of what's immediate. And then we practice the Dhamma. We don't turn our backs on people. You know, one of the great misunderstandings, especially when you don't really understand what the point of the Dhamma is, from that point of compassion married with wisdom and great mindfulness, you're able to act appropriately in every situation. You don't have that veil of ignorance that's blocking you, that self-referential view that alters your actions, your thoughts, your words, and your deeds in some way. Sometimes it's appropriate and sometimes it's not.
It's very interesting watching people in action who do these things, whether they do it consciously or through study or practice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've joked about my husband being a natural Buddhist. He does these things. He doesn't take these things personally. And he says, it's all just going to go away. So all you can do is live your life the way you wish to live it and live it fully. And the other day I saw my son do the same thing. My husband and I were going back and forth on something that we couldn't come to a degree, and it involved him. It was something trivial, but it was causing me a lot of, oh, this, maybe that. And he said, Mom, may I speak now? He's like, huh. He said, this is my son Matthew, he said, the way I see it is this. We did this and this, and we did this and this, and the options are this, this, and this. Either one is fine. And he just put it so clearly to me and so dispassionately, even though it affected him more than it affected me. The decision affected him. Didn't affect me. Well, monetarily, did not. And he was so calm and cool about it. Now, he could have been clever to be calm and cool to get what he wanted. He's smart. But on the other hand, he's a natural facilitator, and he doesn't appeal to emotion that way. He just does this over and over again with people. I see it with his friends. He just calmly addresses what's happening without taking sides or getting angry or anything like that. But it's very, and he's going to be a communications major, he decided.
So apply that to yourself too, Judy. Mm-hmm. When you find yourself getting caught up in it, the 4 weeks ago we started 3 weeks on restraint.
No, I was there for one of them.
So practicing restraint is also at that point when you feel yourself getting agitated, remind yourself, this is not me. This, I don't have to go there. I don't have to attach myself to this anymore. Take a breath. You know, take a step back. Practice that restraint.
The world is full of hooks to
get us attached to it. That's the nature of the world. Yeah, and so I mean, you explained it very well. All these people that are going to get hurt. Well, that's the hook.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing isn't, well, is it true or not? It doesn't matter if it's true. If it occurs, it's what occurs. It's part of dukkha. If it doesn't occur, it's still part of dukkha. You know? What's most important at that point is the present quality of my mind. If I'm losing my mind, I'm no good to anybody, especially myself.
And that's what I really, really have to... That's the perspective of people.
Yeah. And that's always the case. It's always the case, no matter what's occurring.
And it's interesting, again, my sons have also helped pull me more toward a dispassionate view because of what they've experienced when they try and be dispassionate when they're talking about issues with people in school. And when you're in a college campus, it tends to be extremely liberal. And these people are behaving just like I think the evil conservatives are being, evil Republicans, like, you know, certain aspects. And they're doing the same thing to them. And all they are saying is, there's two sides to every story. And they don't want to hear it. And so they've become, they've developed the feeling that this stuff doesn't matter. That they're going to try and live their life well, I think this was very helpful.
I hope so. Kevin, was it helpful for you? Was it helpful for you?
Yes.
Good. Okay. It was. I think it was a good discussion, and it really did relate to the topic tonight of impermanence and not self. To see how the establishment of a self creates a lot of trouble in the world. It really does. Thinking that your views are the right view and it's the only right view, and when you realize that all those views are rooted in ignorance, it does create an awful lot of trouble. But that's ongoing. That's part of recognizing the Four Noble Truths teach. Dukkha occurs. And it's always going to occur. It's always going to be part of the world, whether it's something that people are doing that's creating dukkha, or it's just living in the world, such as floods and hurricanes and those types of things. It's part of living in the world. We can't legislate against what I was saying before. We can't legislate against the First Noble Truth. It wouldn't be a noble truth, would it? There's always going to be suffering in the world. There's always going to be the need for compassion, and the best type of compassion has wisdom as part of it. It's the air conditioner. So, any other questions or comments before we finish with Metta?
A lot to chew on.
So yeah, let's think about the Buddha. This is from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. The Buddha taught this sutta to a group of monks who were disturbed by two things. One is they were living in the forest, and there was a lot of sounds, the animals and stuff, that disturbed their meditation practice. But there was also another competing so-called religious sect that was saying things about them that weren't true and trying to undermine the Sangha. And so they came to the Buddha. One of the problems was, how do we deal with all this noise around us? How do we deal with these animals, et cetera, et cetera? But most importantly, listen to these terrible things. What should we do? We got to retaliate. The Buddha taught him metta. What should we do about our enemies? So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body, and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have come up from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.